Hello, hello, hello. I think we're going to start. If you can sit down or try to. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to the Antiques Book Fair, the first one ever. Round of applause for you. So, in this discussion today, we're talking about a surge in Mexico. Some of the rebellions and revolutions going on right below us, right beneath us, right next to us. And how those struggles circulate, not just there, but here as well. My name is Anto. I live in New York City. And I'm from San Diego region, where I was working with an anarchist collective and a couple of different groups on cross-border struggles and building solidarity between the United States and Mexican anarchists, as well as human rights groups, focused on the militarization of the border and building a bigger network of solidarity. To my left, we have John Ross. John Ross wrote a book.
On the left.
A book called Zapatistas, Making Another World Possible. He's also author of the book Murdered by Capitalism. He's been living in Mexico City for the last 2 decades and reporting, which has appeared in San Francisco Guardian, The Nation, Texas Observer, Counterpunch, Noticias Aliadas, La Jornada, Democracy Now!, and Flashpoints. Very excited to have him here. Over here we have Al Cordon, who has been a publisher of Narco News, which I'm sure all of you have been reading and following these struggles in Oaxaca very closely. He's lived and reported for the past decade alongside social movements throughout Latin America, such as Bolivia, Venezuela, Brazil, Central America, the Caribbean, and primarily Mexico. In 2006, he, along with 60 volunteers, with Narco News, started the Other Journalism, the Other Campaign, which accompanied the Subcomandante Marcos, otherwise known as Delegado Zero, on a national listening tour to Mexico's 32 states and federal districts. It's quite an impressive feat with lots of videos online, a lot of amazing stories about that tour. We're very excited to have them both here. I just want to give a brief introduction about the project I'm working on, and then we're going to go into a 15 to 20 minute each discussion about struggles in Mexico that they've been reporting on for the last 2 decades. And kind of a rising tide from below and to the left. And then we'll take some questions and answers. Sound good?
Sounds good.
So first of all, let me just introduce a product to kind of bridge between folks working in the United States and folks working in Mexico on this kind of solidarity, this revolutionary solidarity. There's a project in the fall, in November of 2007, we call it No Border Camp. No Border Camp is a regional mobilization to confront the rising militarization of the border, immigration laws, the state building, detention centers, and checkpoints. This has been like a 1.5 year organizing going on here, but it dates back to a couple years ago when the discussion started at the New Border Clinch in San Diego. The idea is to build kind of a solidarity between Mexican anarchists, United States anarchists, Catholic groups, human rights groups. Everyone feels kind of the pain and pressure of the border regime, and how that kind of brings together folks on both sides of this line, this enforced line of violence. We have a lot of information upstairs, a lot of stuff you can pick up and learn more about it. We have a website called deletetheborders.org, and it's trying to kind of bridge that dialogue, information, analysis, so we can not just learn about the struggles going on there, but try to carry them to the border and hopefully tear through it. I hope you're excited about it. I have information up here and more at the table upstairs. So with that said, if you can ask any questions about that later, we're going to move right into the talk on Mexico. So first, we have Mr. John Ross.
Right, we should always start on the left. I really am prepared too much, but I'm going to give you a little wrap here. If anybody's got their pocket calendars out, it would be a good thing to kind of follow this here. I live in a country that has a very long memory, where memory does not go away, where what happened in the past is very much in the present, and indeed there is no present without that memory of what happened in the past. We certainly have been trying to take that memory away from us, and this is probably the main goal of neoliberalism, is essentially to erase what came before. My first book on the Zapatistas, not my first book on the Zapatistas, but a previous book on the Zapatistas was called The War Against Oblivion, which dealt with the period from 1994 to 2000. The war against oblivion, because that's what the Zapatistas called their war. La guerra contra el olvido. the war against forgetting, but not forgetting your book in the cafe or your glasses in the classroom, but forgetting everything, obliterating what came before, 500 years of resistance to European invasion, and the millenniums of indigenous culture that have survived since then, you know? And that's what neoliberalism is about. It's about erasing what came before. And that's what the Zapatistas call their war. The war against forgetting. The war against oblivion. The second volume in that series, which deals with, which chronicles what has happened between now and then, is called Making Another World Possible. Between chronicling the years between 2000 and 2006, because that's precisely what the Zapatistas have been doing during that period. They have stopped demanding that the government do things that the government will never do and are building their own autonomy. And indeed, that autonomy is in place. We go to a lot of anti-globalization struggles, we stand on the barricades, and we say things like, another world is possible. Well, the Zapatistas are making that other world possible with their calloused hands and their backs and their paintbrushes and their wheelbarrows and their murals and their collective decision-making and their spirit. And I think that we have a lot to learn from that. I've been traveling around the country for months now, talking to folks about being Zapatistas where we live. And when we think about what that means, you know, we have some examples, concrete examples. People know about South Central Farms in Los Angeles. This was a Zapatista space. This was an autonomous space where people took decisions collectively. This was a place that served the community and spoke truth to power. This was 14 acres of downtown industrial L.A. that was sown with the kind of foods that immigrant families need to have. You know, the yuca and the cilantro and the epizote and good, uncorrupted, non-GMO Zapatista corn. It was an autonomous space. And, of course, you know, the first Mexican-American mayor of Los Angeles since 1842 decided to send in the sheriffes, and the sheriffs came in. It was about a three-week battle. People threw themselves in front of the bulldozers, tied themselves to the trees, and in the end they were removed from the premises. For what? I guess you all know by now. What do you think what is being in place where South Central Farms was? One, just one in, tell me. A Walmart distribution center. You got that. But, you know, I get every day, I get emails from the South Central farmers telling me they're taking a lot here, they're taking a lot there, taking lots all around Los Angeles to grow food for the community collectively, autonomous zones, establishing autonomous zones. It's a good example of being Zapatistas where we are. Down on the Lower East Side, one community garden after another. This is a way of taking back space from the developers. I just came from a demonstration in front of a building on 3rd Street, 47 3rd Street, 15 tenants, they've been there 30 years, one dude comes along, one multimillionaire who owns the building, he wants them all out so he can make a mansion. And we saw the floor plans for the 5 floors, you know. We have to take those spaces back from those people that are building the mansions, you know. I like what Neil Young has said about that, burning down the mansions. So, anyway, you too can be Zapatistas where you live, you know? And it's a good start, you know, here to be doing this kind of work, you know. All kinds of work is Zapatista work, so long as we do it in a collective way. We don't have hierarchies, we don't have patriarchies. We make our decisions together and we move together, you know. And always with that principle, the Zapatista principle of mandar obedeciendo, which essentially translates to governing by obeying the will of the people, no? Or serving the community, no? So I think there's a place for us in this, you know? And I know that we're doing it work very much like this, but, you know, maybe it adds a little touch of romance, a little exotic to say we're doing this work like the Zapatistas. You know, we're being Zapatistas wherever we are. So I think that there have been a number of social movements in Mexico in the last couple of years, and certainly in 2006, that were historic. The resistance in Oaxaca that went on for 8 months and still continues, although the APU and the teachers are not occupying the plaza, but certainly continues and will continue. We're actually only 2 months away from another teacher strike. Was an historic example of people building 1,000 barricades, man, all around Oaxaca and defending their turf. You know, people got killed. 26 people got killed. Some of you knew Brad Will. He was a struggler down here on the Lower East Side and a lot of other places. But he was only one of 26 people that were killed by the death squads of the governor, Mrs. Ruiz. You know, what was that about? What was their struggle in Oaxaca about? People demanded the removal of this very oppressive governor who had been illegally elected, no? The new ersatz government in Mexico, run by a guy named Felipe Calderón, who stole the election last July 2nd, thereby triggering the largest political demonstrations in the history of the country, 2 million people on the streets of Mexico City, living in the streets for 7 weeks, 49 days, you know? And Calderón is the president, and he does have the power to remove Ulises Ruiz from power. They could get what the term is disappearance of powers, because he's been guilty of egregious violations of human rights that have been confirmed by virtually every national, international human rights organization that has come to Oaxaca. But Calderón will not remove him. Why? Because Ulises Ruiz is a member of the party that ran Mexico for 7 decades. How about that? 7 decades, right? No party had been in power in the known universe for that period of time. The Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI. They have 100 votes in Congress. Calderón cannot pass his legislative package if he were to remove Ulises Ruiz because the PRI wouldn't vote for him. And what's at the top of this legislative package? The privatization of Mexico's oil wealth, the privatization of Mexico's petroleum resource, the Pemex Corporation, which was expropriated and nationalized by President Lázaro Cárdenas back in 1938. No, that's what's at the root of what's going on in Oaxaca. This past year, we also had, as I mentioned, the largest political demonstration in the history of the country. They were historic. There was no other way to say that. An election was stolen on July 2nd. It was an election that the U.S. could not lose after losing one election after another all throughout the continent. A week before the election, the New York Times ran a lead article in the magazine section talking about the populist at the border, referring to Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the left-wing candidate, or center candidate in that election. Populist, if we go back and take a look at what Dick Cheney was saying during that same period, was how they were referring to Hugo Chavez, the terrorist populist, no? So U.S. could not afford to have a social democratic regime on its borders, no? López Obrador won that election. The election was stolen. I could talk for hours about how it was stolen. I'm sure Al could do to the same thing, and it generated a social movement that was extremely historic. We had never seen so many people in motion at one time. No. The Zapatistas have been out with the other campaign from one end of the country to the other. It's much slower organizing. It's organizing that goes out there and listens to the people and tries to bring together all the little resistances in the country to weave one big tapestry of resistance, no? And it is, you have to go to communities, listen to the people, go back to communities, bring people together, suggest ways of lining things up and doing it all from the bottom, you know? What is the timetable for the other campaign? Well, I think that brings me back to what I said before about history, you know? And, as I say, I live in a country where, if I can turn this off, I live in a country where history is part of the present, no? So the thing about the pocket calendars. In 1810, the Mexican underclass, which was actually a third Afro-Mexican at liberation, the black and brown underclass, marched 100,000 strong on Mexico City to throw off the yoke of the Spanish crown. No? It didn't succeed in 1810. It took a long time before that happened, but the fuse was lit in 1810. No? Let's fast forward exactly 100 years. In 1910, an election was stolen by a dictator that had been in power for 34 years, and the candidates who had run against him had been flapped into jail. And from behind the bars of the jail in San Luis Potosí, Francisco Madero proclaimed the Mexican Revolution, the first great upsurge, uprising of landless farmers, indigenous people, the working class in the history of the Americas, and indeed set the style for revolution in the 20th century. It precedes the Russian Revolution. So here's the thing about the pocket calendars, no? 2007, 2008, 2009, the countdown's there, 2010, no? This is not just a numbers game, folks. The people where I live remember what happened, and they talk about what could happen by 2010. So mark it down on your pocket calendars. Revolution on your border is definitely brewing.
Thank you all for coming. And for lending us some of your valuable time to come. The Narco News, as Anto mentioned, had during all of 2006, what we first started out as a pilot project for 2 weeks, when Greg Berger and Barrett Hawes and I and a few others went and accompanied Subcomandante Marcos in the Yucatan Peninsula, ended up being then was going to be a 6-month project to accompany him across the country, and what ended up being an 11-month project because his tour of all of Mexico took that long. Others here in the room who participated in that, I'd like to thank them for coming. Sean Geary, Simon Fitzgerald, Kristen Bricker, Josh Bregman, and Mark Swear were here. Would you all just raise your hands, because I want people to be able to go up to you later and talk to you and hear more directly from you, and you'll be able to hear more from them on Wednesday night at the Narco News 7th Anniversary Celebration. I also want to mention that with us today is Chacha Connor of the Supermodels from Oaxaca, and one of the two people most responsible for me learning Spanish and coming to Latin America, who took me there when I was 24 in 1984, Johanna Lawrenson of the Abby Hoffman Activist Fund, and who is the widow of my late teacher, Abby Hoffman. And so thank all of you for coming. You've all been part of this project for a while, and the labor we did at Narco News in the past year with 300 original stories from the other campaign trail and 700 original translations of those stories and the 7 video newsreels in various languages could not have happened unless it was a collective effort like this. I want to talk about, I presume most people here are familiar with the Zapatistas and are familiar at least somewhat with the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca, which held the downtown of the state capital of Oaxaca for 153 days in 2006. That's 3 times as long, for example, as the Paris Commune, which lasted 50 days. And I believe that the fallout and the consequences of what has gone on in Oaxaca must be studied by serious social change agents, and especially anarchists and anarcho-syndicalists, because for 153 days, really, you can't say that the state existed. The state existed, but people governed their affairs without a state power and without bureaucracy. The state existed in a kind of exile, where the governor could not appear in public, where his police forces could not appear in uniform, where they had to resort to the paramilitary death squad activities that John mentioned before. And, but what I found fascinating, we had a lot of reports out of Oaxaca in the mainstream media and in the alternative media, and most of them portrayed a big dust bowl of tear gas and battles over barricades, which certainly happened and went on for the better part of the year. During this, a North American woman named Nancy Davies, who's 72 years old, who's lived 8 years in Oaxaca, went out there with her cane, she's arthritic, and began to talk to the people who were involved in the movement. First with the, she did her first article on the teacher's strike on May 25th of last year. We published it on Narco News. And then she went and accompanied it at every step. And as everybody knows, on June 14th, the state, 3,000 state police came in. They attacked at the teacher strike encampment, which included teachers, their families, their kids, their parents, and plus representatives of other social movements, many of whom were part of the Zapatista Other campaign in Oaxaca. And so you had a situation in which the police came in at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning with billy clubs, with guns, with tear gas. A helicopter was dropping tear gas on this encampment, and the people ran for their lives. And they found themselves a little outside of the center of town, and suddenly they looked around, they realized there's 15,000 of them, there's 3,000 of the state police and the municipal police involved, and they turned around and counterattacked with the police with nothing but sticks and stones. They took away their shields, they took away their helmets, they took away their guns. They took 8 or 9 of them as political prisoners, in a sense, and the rest of the police ran for their lives. And for the next 5 months, really until the federal police came in after Brad Wilk was assassinated, they held not only the downtown of the city of Oaxaca, but the working class and poor neighborhoods surrounding it, and many of the regions and highways and urban and rural centers throughout what is Mexico's second or third poorest state and its only majority indigenous state. This was different, though, than, say, the L.A. riots of 1992, I think it was, when in response to the Rodney King verdict, when the cops got off, there was a series of riots that ebbed and that rose and ebbed within 5 days and maybe a couple more weeks of skirmishes. What is it that motivates people to take their ground and hold their ground for 5 months against tremendous repression? Well, they weren't just fighting against the dictator Ulysses Ruiz and the illegitimate regime of that was coming in of Felipe Calderón. They were fighting for something called a popular assembly, a way to govern themselves without the corrupted version of democracy between quotes, of electoral democracy that's so governed now by money and access to the media, but by direct democracy through popular assemblies on the local level and later on the state level. They were fighting to defend something that they felt worthy enough to defend, that they would go out and take those blows and subject themselves to these risks of life and limb, to lose so many months of income for this. And so what Nancy Davies did is she went, instead of going to the barricades, went to the assembly hall and chronicled all of this. And just yesterday, the galley of our first Narco News book came off the press as the people decide Oaxaca's popular assembly. We're making this collector's edition. There's only 100 of them available upstairs, along with some of the videos that were made in Oaxaca and other parts during the other campaign trail last year. As activists or independent media people from the first world, with our ability to do this comes a tremendous burden and responsibility. I always grew up as a kid with a chip on my shoulder. I couldn't afford college. I don't have a degree. I became involved in it as a teenager in the anti-nuclear movement, generally with people who were of a higher socioeconomic status than me. But it was when I went and lived and shut up for a while, really, and without reporting, and lived in indigenous communities in Mexico, that I realized that I didn't have much grounds having this chip on my shoulder, that any of us who knows how to read and write who owns a camera, who owns a laptop or a computer, or has even access to this stuff. Anyone who's ever been on an airplane has a very unique privilege in this world. Because in Mexico, 95% of the public will never step on an airplane. And so that's something to keep in mind, I think, when the Solidarity Brigades go down, when the Revolution Tours go down, when people go down to be human rights observers, is with these tools that we have access to comes a tremendous responsibility. And I think that those of us in the alternative media have not done enough to make sure that what we report is accurate, to research our facts, so that, for example, after the police attack on June 14th in Oaxaca, the majority of the media, including the alternative media, posted there were 8 deaths, 9 deaths, 11 deaths. When it turned out there were none, instead of focusing on the poor kid that got his eye poked out by a billy club, which is just as big an outrage, I think that in activism and in independent communication, we tend to go on knee-jerk and say, well, look for the deaths, look for the scoreboard up above. But Nancy Davies and others who participated in this project have shown us a way of doing Zapatista journalism, of looking below, of listening, of studying before we take pen to paper or post things, and when we're wrong, of printing corrections as large as the error, in the same place as the error. And so we're involved as workers, really, as journalists, as documentary filmmakers, as radio reporters, and as people who do all kinds of other things other than this, just to make a living. As a workers' movement of communicators, to try to change the way that journalism is done. Not to just try to convince the New York Times or the mainstream media to do things better, because with the profit motive they're on, they never will. But to supplant them, to replace them, to be better than them, so that eventually they're undermined and the people come to different sources of media, which the last 10 years we've seen happen on many, many different fronts. I wanted to keep my remarks short because I want to hear from people here, and I think it always makes for a more interesting discussion if it's two ways. And so thank you for your time, and long live anarchy, beat state.
Thank you both for talking and sharing your thoughts on this. We're going to go to questions and answers now. We hope you keep your questions short and to the point, hopefully for a minute or two, so we can have a lot of people talking. And stand up when you ask your question. I'm going to start the questions off for one for both of you.
We want answers, not questions.
Together.
Okay.
So the question I want to start off with is this discussion of timetables you talked about.
Yeah.
And kind of the different modes of time, from being on the barricade to being on the assembly, or from traveling to working there for 2 decades. And I'm wondering if either you can talk about the different kind of times that the Zapatistas use, or the times in Oaxaca, and if they're similar in their strategies of resistance, and how we can learn from their timetables and their scheduling and the process of working in resistance over time, within time.
I don't know that there is a timetable. There is a metabolism that reacts to things and suddenly explodes and will sustain a struggle for a period of time and then enter into a period of quiescence or apparent quiescence and then suddenly explodes again, you know. Anybody here is a student of the film The Battle of Algiers, but if you remember, at the end of The Battle of Algiers, when everybody comes out of the Kasbah, it always says, nobody knows how it happened, you know? Well, everybody knows how it happened. And in a real sense, we're in one of those periods of quiescence at this, as we talk here today. But that's always a period you really have to look at very closely, because that's when people are putting together their experiences, translating what has happened to them into new forms of struggle and new ways of going after power, of attacking power. So, you know, when I say 1810, 1910, 2010, there is some historical basis for that. One of the goals of the other campaign is the writing, the calling of a new constitutional convention that would write a new anti-capitalist, anti-neoliberal constitution for the country. So, you know, there is some historical basis there, and we'll begin to talk about that 100-year period. And we might also recall that, if I'm not mistaken, my latest information is that on November 28th, 2011, the Mayan cycle ends and the new Mayan cycle begins. These dates are really very important. They may seem, you know, arbitrary to us, but they are very important in the life of this country that lives as much in the past as it lives in the present. Having said that, I want to say that the history of revolution in Mexico is that it begins in a lot of different places at once. It's not like there's one movement. Mexico's a big political stage with a lot of actors on it. And indeed, the revolution of 1910 begins in the north with Francisco Villa, begins in the center of the country with Emiliano Zapata and other revolutionaries in their respective regions. So any new revolution in Mexico is going to have to be a regional revolution. This thing is going to happen simultaneously in a lot of different places. It's going to take a while to get there. Again, just to kind of, you know, maybe some people think, oh, this is science fiction, this isn't going to happen, this is, you know, this is the United States. You know, Mexico, by the way, is the United States of Mexico, is the United States of North America. So it isn't just one United States, but, you know, this couldn't happen, you know. This country is now setting up those conditions, 700-mile wall along the border, right? In addition to that, you've got a migra now called ICE. Can you dig it? ICE. How cynical can you get? You know, immigration and customs enforcement. ICE has been militarized. You have soldiers just back from Baghdad patrolling the border, you know, from one end, from the Gulf of California to, or the Pacific Ocean to the Gulf of Mexico at this point, you know. People cannot come across anymore, right? Maybe some people throw themselves across or able to get across. The flow will continue because of the desperation, desperate need that's there. But it has somewhat diminished. And what that means is that all those people, the young people who are the real lifeblood of the country and the people that take the most initiative, who leave the country because they don't have work where they are, because conditions are not what they can do to feed their families, can't get out of the country. Out-migration is traditionally a safety valve, they call it in the textbooks, you know. Well, if you shut down that safety valve, you're creating those kind of social pressures within the country that are slight oppression, you know. And the other part of that is, on this side of the border, you have ICE now sending 13,000 workers back to Mexico in the last couple of months. That's going to continue all year. We'll be in the hundreds of thousands. Those are people that can no longer send money back to their families. Mexico lives on $16 billion of remissions each year, money being sent not just to the family, but to the town, to the region. It's, you know, the anti-poverty program in the country. If you cut off that flow and diminish that flow, you're increasing that pressure cooker just a little bit more. No? So again, you have forces on the move in the country. We've seen Oaxaca, we've seen Mexico City, we've seen Chiapas in this last year. Those forces are going, that pressure is going to increase all over the country. So 2010 is not an unrealistic timetable for talking about the beginning of qualitative social change. Social change comes in Mexico when we get to this point that they call a coyuntura, when in fact those objective forces, the neoliberalism, the economy coming from without, natural disasters, droughts, all of those things that, you know, you can't really change, meets the subjective forces, the folks on the barricades in Oaxaca, the other campaign, all of the social organizing, and when that reaches critical mass, you get real social change in the country. When in fact the subjective forces can overtake the objective conditions, then you get meaningful social change or revolution in Mexico.
Just briefly, I think a lot of first world journalists and activists that go not only to Chiapas but to other parts of Mexico or to Bolivia or other parts of Latin America to cover or to study or to support social movements have an immediate culture shock. I know I did, because it really is not reactive to, the movements are not so reactive to the electoral clock or the big news story or the big scandal. I remember about 7 years ago when I was sued and Narco News was sued by the National Bank of Mexico, or Banamex, which is now part of Citibank. And our co-defendant, a journalist from Mexico named Mario Menendez Rodriguez, who began in the 1960s with a radical magazine called Porqué, and later with a newspaper called Por Esto, we went lawyer shopping.
And later joined the PRI.
We went lawyer shopping, and we went, after the lawyer shop, we went down Fifth Avenue. And this is New York, and everybody's walking very, very fast. Now, Mario had traveled with Che Guevara in Bolivia, in Africa, in the Caribbean, and he traveled with General Giap of Vietnam and Laos as a war correspondent. And I said, Mario, why won't you walk faster? This is New York. Everybody here walks fast. And he said, well, Che Guevara told me that when you're a revolutionary, you walk at your own pace. And an example is, you know, I might respond to provocations from my good friend who's on my left here, but it doesn't matter. When you know what you're doing is right, you just keep moving forward and keep doing it and keep doing the work, and that's what's really here, and that's what we're here to do, and that's what we keep on doing. And so the thing I think that's amazing about the Zapatistas or about the Popular Assembly of Oaxaca is they march to their own drummer. They march to their own clock, and they're not letting other people tell them which way to go unless those people are part of their efforts.
Now we're taking questions from the audience. If you have a question, please stand up or raise your hand.
I have a question.
Stand up.
I have a question about how the geographical and political situation. The poorest parts of Mexico are the south, right? EZLN, obviously, Chiapas, Oaxacans, and Rebellion. And the more conservative parts historically, the more conservative parts hold in the north. So the PAN is a stronghold in the north. Has the other campaign, how has it been received? Has it gone from the north? If there is, in 2010, this, if that were to occur, the big revolution, it would be a civil war, it seems to me, between the North.
Did everyone hear the question?
We are answering the question.
Is the other campaign going to the North?
Why don't you let him go?
The question is about the difference between the North and the South of Mexico. Where the South is the most poorest, and a lot of the social movements are, the North is historically the most conservative and the most receptive to the PAN. So the question is, if there ever is a revolution, wouldn't it be a civil war?
Okay, I'm going to jump in here. And there is a question about the other campaign, and maybe Al will suggest that there. You know, I think it's arbitrary. You know, there was a whole lot made in the elections that López Obrador won 16 southern states and Calderón won 16 northern states. No? As if everybody in the North is rich, no? The North is the zone closest to the United States. Of course, the border is the site of, well, a lot less maquiladoras than were there after NAFTA, but about 1,100 are still functioning on the border. So what that does is attract people from the South. So you have colonies of mestizo and indigenous people. Some emphasis on the indigenous people, because when we take a look at Tijuana, for example, or Juarez, in Tijuana you have whole colonies of Mixtecos and Zapotecos from Oaxaca. Oaxaca has recreated itself on the border there, you know? And the same is also true with Ciudad Juarez in terms of Tarahumara or Rarámuri, people from that immediate area and other indigenous people, but indeed poor people. Poor people go north So that they can allegedly find work, you know, in the Maquila Daughters and these sweatshops that have been set up by transnational corporations. So it's kind of arbitrary. The PAN controls the political structure in the North, the PAN and the PRI, which are now just about, the same. They blended into each other. But that doesn't mean that you're going to see the North versus the South, no? There will be plenty of action along the border. The most vulnerable and the most strategic part of Mexico as far as the U.S. is concerned. And indeed, you do have a sizable indigenous population in the north of the country as well. The desert cultures are small. We might plug here the encampment that's going on right now in Mexicali, just outside of Mexicali. The Zapatista comandantes are there in defense of the fishing rights of the Cucapa and Chilliwa people who've been denied the right to fish in the Gulf of California because it's been declared a protected zone for ecotourism. And so, indeed, their millennium-old culture is in danger of dying, no? And so, you know, you guys can go down, by the way. You could be a Zapatista on the border of Mexicali, you know? And sit with the comandantes and with the Chilliwa Cucapa people to defend their fishing rights. This is all I'm saying. I think it's arbitrary to say that there is a rich North and a poor South.
It's a myth that northern Mexico is substantially more right-wing or more conservative or less radical or less conscious than southern and central Mexico. The electoral left in Mexico, which is the Democratic Revolution Party of the aforementioned Andrés Manuel López Obrador and others, is very poorly organized in the north. It did not have poll watchers at a great many of the polling places in those northern states. What Kristen and Simon and Josh and I and others who actually went to from town to town in northern Mexico found is that Rebel Mexico exists in the north too. The problem is that even in on the alternative media, we kind of buy these things. I know when I wrote my analysis of the electoral fraud for New Left Review, and they sent back my first draft, they go, no, but we want you to address this issue about how the North is conservative and the South is more radical. And I said, no, that's not the case. Calderón did not win every state they say he won in the North. He stole those states by fraud. And in none of those states did he win as many votes as they said he would. In Guanajuato, more people voted for Calderón than there are voters in the state. Okay? This was a level of electoral fraud that would make Jeb Bush and Katherine Harris blush. But there were no poll watchers from the opposition party, which is poorly organized in the north, to prove that at the time. That's part of the problem. And it's one of the reasons, I think, as John mentioned, that Marcos, the subcomandante, and that media level comandantes like Tacho and David and Comandante Susana are now in Monterrey. They're now in Aguascalientes. They're now outside of Mexicali, beginning to fan out and organize as they began 20 odd years ago in the Lacandon jungle to try to sow the serious fights together. The listening tour of Marcos last year, which invited anybody to come out and speak, and to be part of it if they weren't a militant, if they weren't an official or a candidate or a militant in any political party, was kind of to take the x-ray of what's going on. And recently, I think he made a comment about, well, that was to find out who's really organizing on the local level, because we're going to go and live and organize with them, and then who's just showing up to be in the photo. And so now, I think you'll see by where these comandantes go and live and work, where they've identified in their x-ray of the country that the rebellion can come from, the simultaneous rebellion, as John mentioned.
One more point on that is that in northern Mexico and in southern California or southern Arizona, there is kind of an organizing going on between anarchists and between indigenous groups and migrant groups towards kind of breaking down the militarization of the border as well. And that's happening in solidarity with Zapatistas and also with a lot of Oaxacans who are up there. So there is a dynamic fluid process going on there.
Um, you mentioned the fraud in the election, and I was just wondering, are there any confirmed reports or evidence of any external pressure by, say, U.S. or other Western governments or institutions on that election?
The actual hit campaign against López Obrador, which, you know, this was a television commercial campaign, no? That would show you a mugshot of López Obrador and then some over like Hugo Chavez or Su Comandante Marcos or a riot or a strike or something like that. And then stamped on the screen the word peligro, danger, in red letters, and would appear four times in one commercial break on the Televisa News at 10:30 each night, which is where most Mexicans unfortunately get their news, no? And this attempt to hypnotize Mexicans into the illusion that López Obrador was a peligro to Mexico was designed by a guy named Dick Morris. Dick Morris campaigned against Evo Morales in Bolivia, against Daniel in Nicaragua. He also put Clinton in the White House in 96. He's a Fox News commentator, and he has his own political consultant firm. Which in fact worked for Fox, for the Pound candidate in 2000 as well. It's interesting that NAFTA, you remember NAFTA? It actually has a chapter in there which talks about political consultation as being able to transcend borders. So we get all these carpetbaggers now coming to Mexico to design the elections there, no? This campaign that went on from January through the week before the July elections, it really just continues, was financed by several businessmen's councils. One of them was a businessmen's council composed of transnational corporations. And who were the biggest contributors to that particular transnational council? I can hear it from you out there. Walmart, now the biggest employer in Mexico, 700 stores, largest retailer, largest seller of tortillas in the country, and Halliburton, largest subcontractor or contractor to Pemex, the national oil corporation in the country. So there's some leads that you can take and follow in terms of how the U.S. transnational corporations and their votes manipulated this election. How can you add something to that?
Well, of course, the United States government and corporations are involved in every aspect of Mexican political life. It's been well documented and reported that the embassy has the most extensive telephone bugging system in Mexico, internet monitoring system. I don't assume ever that anything I say on the phone or do online is not seen or heard by those folks. Just one telling moment is after the election had occurred last year, the White House press secretary congratulated Felipe Calderon on his victory before the National Elections Commission had declared him the victor. And the White House then had to backpedal the next day in response to an enterprising reporter's questions and say, well, no, actually it's not solved yet. The same thing happened in 1988 with the fraud that elected, between quotes, Carlos Salinas de Gortari. George Bush Sr. from the Reagan White House was the one who called Gortari to say, oh, congratulations on your victory. Because, I mean, with what they've done in Florida and Ohio, and I don't think it's any big surprise, electoral politics cannot work under a system that is so prone to fraud. How many millions and billions of dollars went into the U.S. electoral campaign's last presidential race or into the Mexican electoral campaign's last presidential race? But the game is fixed. Electoral democracy no longer exists. And so I think one of the goals of an event like the Anarchist Book Fair is people are searching for other ways to do things from below, where it, certainly the U.S. government didn't have anything to do with counting the votes in the Oaxacan Popular Assembly, because there was no secret ballot, because there you speak and your word and your vote is yours and it's public.
Actually, George Bush calls Calderon on Tuesday, the election's held on Sunday. The results are still coming in, the preliminary tally is still coming in, and Bush calls Calderon from Air Force One. Check it out. Air Force One, no? So, you know, there was a lot of manipulation in this election. I just, you know, since we're addressing issues here as much, being Zapatistas where we are, you know, 5 days after the election, Lopez Obrador called his people to the Zocalo, the Great Central Plaza. 500,000 people show up. He says, come back in 2 weeks on July 16th, and 1.2 million people show up, right? Then he says, oh, this is good. Come back again in 2 weeks on July 30th, we get 2.4 million people, exponentially expanding all the time. You know, folks, George Bush stole the 2000 election. He stole the 2004 election. Who got into the streets? They couldn't believe it in Mexico that no one was into the streets after what happened in Florida, no? But, you know, we have to have that kind of ability to mobilize our indignation against the way this system has brutalized so-called democracy in this country.
How the sort of increasing transnational commodification of biofuels is putting pressure on the food supply in Mexico, and how that's playing into the dynamic of the social movement there, like the rising prices of corn and things like that.
We just published a story, not from Mexico, but from Brazil, about the ethanol deal that Bush signed with Brazilian President Lula, who was a left-winger. He was a machine shop union organizer. He'd run for president various times, and on the fourth time, he finally won. And there were many great hopes back in 2003 when he took office that he would somehow be different. And what our writer concludes is that this ethanol plan to put vast tracts of Amazon lands to the development of corn and other high ethanol crops, not yet hemp, unfortunately, it's really part of a game going on by the very forces that control the oil industry. As oil has peaked and supplies and reserves are going down, Mexico's oil supplies are going down at a faster level than almost any other countries on Earth. But the pressure has not been on Mexico so much to have these fuels because, A, you have a lot of hunger and you also still have a lot of lands that are in the hands of something called ejidos, which are communally run farmlands. They're trying to do away with that. Until they can do away with that, and they're doing away with it every day, that it's going to be very hard for multinational corporations to come in there and start doing ethanol farms. So they're concentrating on Brazil, on Paraguay, where the Bush family just bought a bunch of land. And the other problem in Mexico, that about half the country suffers significant droughts at least half the year. The places that used to be florid and damp and humid are now dry, and there are water shortages. And so Mexico, like much of the United States, is really going to be screwed by the environmental things more than South America is, where the rainforest is still, although it's under attack, a much larger land mass. So, and I mean, it's interesting to see the tensions between Brazil and Venezuela now. And Hugo Chavez has spoken on this, saying, you know, why put all these acres of land to grow fuel when there are people who still don't have food? But they found in this ethanol plan a way to have a centralized form of alternative energy. And, of course, it repeats the same vices as every centralized form of alternative energy.
Actually, what Chavez said was, a poco, we're going to grow corn, food, to power the cars of North Americans. He said that in Buenos Aires when Bush was on this disastrous tour of Latin America. Hey, folks, this is what's going on. Under NAFTA, Mexico has been importing 6 million tons of bad corn every year. 40 to 60% of that is transgenic GMO corn. Mexico has 600 distinct strains of corn. GMO corn homogenizes those distinct very adaptable strains, which are regional corns, by which farmers know how to save their seeds and which seeds to use. Incredibly, the first transgenic corn in Mexico was found in the Sierra de Juarez in the state of Oaxaca. Oaxaca and Puebla is where corn was domesticated 7,000 years ago. No? And we're getting 36 million tons of corn since 2000 from the U.S. There will be an increase now because Mexico doesn't have enough corn to complete what it needs to do this year. The price of corn is now at its highest in the world market in many, many decades, no? Because of this ethanol scam. This ethanol scam is a way where big corporate growers can get increased subsidies from the U.S. government to grow corn for fuel. Those subsidies are larger than the subsidies they're getting to dump corn in Mexico. Get about $2,100 an acre to grow corn that you dump across the border in Mexico, and so you can sell it below cost and still make out like a bandit. Well, now ethanol production, the subsidies are about twice that, no? The result of this has been interesting. In the first 50 days of Felipe Calderón's presidency, the price of corn went up from 6 pesos to 18 pesos. 6 pesos tripled to 18 pesos. It's come down a little bit now, but it's still 40% more than it was before. Now, you know, folks, we think about tortilla as being kind of a food scooper. You know, we kind of use it, get it up there, get it into our mouths. But for 13 million Mexican children living in extreme poverty, the tortilla is the only thing they have to eat. Maybe a little chili, maybe if there's some beans, but the tortilla is the staple of life. No? So this thing has a lot of ramifications. Many of us have been working in this transgenic thing, looking at GMO corn for a while, think actually that there's a lot of speculation going on here. The corn's being held off market to up the price so that our father, who are in St. Louis, the Monsanto Corporation, can sell its Terminator seed in Mexico. Its GMO seed is currently, you cannot plant GMO corn in a Mexican milpa or in a corn field. Plenty of it comes in from the outside, but the law says you can't do that, which means Monsanto can't sell its seed in the country, force farmers to sign contracts to buy that seed. My friend Sylvia Romero calls it bioslavery, you know. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of manipulation going on here in order to get Monsanto and Novartis and the rest of big biotech in the country so that they can sell their seed to Mexico, to the Mexican farmers. Folks, that's the end of Mexican farmers.
A lot of times these struggles get reduced to stories of electoral fraud and kicking Ruiz out, whereas it's a larger story of resistance to colonization for 500 years. So how do we as radicals kind of translate that story and try to support those struggles without reducing it to one story of electoral fraud or electoral politics, but more about resistance to colonization?
Well, it's what we try to do day in, day out, is form a deeper sense of what the people are saying. Certainly, for example, in Oaxaca, the big demand is that Ulysses Ruiz, the governor, be removed from his position of power. That's the slogan. That's the spear at the front of a longer hour. And I don't have a problem. If the people of Oaxaca are saying that's our number one demand, well, we report what they say is their number one demand. We don't get to say, well, what they're really fighting for is Zapatismo or anarcho-syndicalism or, you know, seizing state power or whatever it is. We can't, as journalists or as communicators, put the words in their mouth. That's what's gotten them marching. That's what's gotten them holding the turf for so long. And I think there is a utility to these hot button matters and to the fall of a particular dictator. The danger, of course, is, let's say Ulysses had resigned. I was joking with some friends during the past year. Well, they keep saying Ulysses should get out, but if he gets out, they replace him with another free member, because that's the party in power in Oaxaca, and does the movement then go away? So there's some danger to that. At the same time, that's what the APO and the movements in Oaxaca know, is getting people out in the streets. So I don't think there's a huge conflict between doing both. I think you have to do both. I don't think you can water the thing down to being just one demand. Just like with the Zapatistas, there were many people who for years thought it was just an indigenous rights movement, and who got very upset during the other campaign when it began talking about appropriating factories in urban centers and the maquiladoras along the border and worker control of the means of production. That upset a lot of people who just thought they should be quaint little Indians in their place, being an identity politics group. However, you do also have to cover the indigenous rights part of it. And it's all holistic, but in the end, only one thing goes in the headline, sure.
I think one of the misinterpretations of what happened around the election is that it was really about electoral politics, or Andres Manuel López Obrador, or the Party of the Democratic Revolution, or whatever. You know, in a real sense, there's this expression that Andres Manuel became the costal, or the burlap bag, where everybody deposits their grievances. And he was clever enough to be able to articulate those grievances. But it was the question of the elections was much larger to the elections. Selection was really, if you couldn't put class and race issues on the ballot, that was it. Because you're talking about a brown underclass of 70 million people who saw López Obrador as their candidate, and you saw this very white, tiny elite as represented by Felipe Calderón. So those issues of class and race became very much involved in the election. The election was not just one of who cast the most ballots, who did the most fraud, who stole the election, who made the falsest promises. It really was this expression from down below of people that were demanding a change in the country to stop neoliberalism from indeed dominating their lives, no? And I will throw this out here to kind of stimulate some stuff. I think that the other campaign missed the boat. Missed the boat entirely. When you have 2 million people in the street demanding that an election that was stolen, clearly to many people who are disillusioned with the electoral system, are in the streets living under tents, at the height of the rainy season, shaking their fist at the sky and saying, "Huevi, huevi, el pueblo no se mueve," it rains and it rains and the people don't move. That's where the other campaign needed to be. It needed to be right there on the streets of Mexico City, in those camps, talking to people about how phony the electoral system is. People were ready to listen.
About 10 minutes left. I'd just be interested in Al's response to that. It's a question that I know the two of you and other folks have disagreed on that specific question. But maybe both your response, but then also, like, how do you think the other campaign might have played a role in that in a real way, in a way that would not take it away from its debate and from what you said?
Well, one thing I would have thought, the Zapatistas held a National Democratic Convention back in 1994. It's not they have the franchise. You know, in fact, that stems from a meeting that was held during the Mexican Revolution in the state of Aguascalientes in 1914. That's what they named that their first CND after. Well, López Obrador culminated his, this planton, this encampment in the city with this National Democratic Convention. But it was totally imposed from the top. You know, the Zapatistas should have been in there, should have been in the camps, talking about how we're going to democratize this, how we're going to do this thing from down below, putting forth their proposals and unmasking the electoral system, as many people had seen it. So I think that was real concrete. It was just getting into the street and saying, you know, we're going to be part of this encampment and doing that kind of talking, rather than separating themselves from the movement. The vanguard sometimes gets so far ahead of the so-called masses, I like to call them the persons, that, you know, that indeed they can't even see what's behind them.
As a journalist, as a native North American, I don't consider it my job to tell the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, nor the other campaign, nor the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca, nor any other social movement I cover, what they should and shouldn't be doing on strategic or tactical grounds. We bring with us a lot of presumptions coming from different cultures. And one of them is that we somehow have the great political smarts to tell them what to do, to be the left version of Dick Morris. I've never believed that. I've had many strategic and tactical difficulties with what people have done when I've covered them. But one thing I know about the Zapatistas is with no money, with no institutional power, they took back the plantations where 400,000 people live and learn to govern them autonomously without a cent or a peso of government money. That says to me, they know something about what they're doing. Just like the Popular Assembly in Oaxaca held the whole capital for 150 days, that says to me, they know something of what they're doing. Now, I've won some political battles in my time before I was a journalist, and I know something about winning battles. But I think most activists and journalists have never won serious political battles, and they're the ones who speak most loudly trying to tell other groups, particularly in the developing world, how they should or shouldn't be running their movement. My job isn't to tell them how to do it, it's to report how they do it.
Well, why didn't you report on the fact that the Zapatistas' other campaign traveled around the country with a portrait of Joe Stalin at the front of the march at every demonstration in southern Mexico, right on into Mexico City? If you can't criticize that, criticize the display of the man who represents totalitarianism, who is so totally the opposite of what anarchism is, of what we are about in this world, then, you know, you're just reporting, you're not reporting all the news out, you're cheerleading.
The poster of Joseph Stalin left the other campaign in July and went on to the Zocalo with the supporters of Andrés Manuel López Obrador against the electoral fraud, and that caused a falling out between the Communist Party of Mexico and the other campaign, because the other campaign itself didn't, as a group, as a coalition, put up that poster. The other campaign said, we're not censoring the posters. It's the first time that anarchists and indigenous and autonomists and Marxist-Leninists and Maoists and Trotskyites were able to begin to work together and put down those differences with the common goal of defeating capitalism. And that meant there were a lot of expressions that I might not have liked, but it's not my job to be a speech cop or a censor and say what should be done. But I'll ask you, John, if you think it's so important to denounce, why didn't you denounce it when they signed up with your boy, López Obrador?
My boy, yeah. My boy.
Why didn't you?
It wasn't there. It was on one. There was indeed one.
We'll publish a photo of it, folks.
There's one portrait of Joe Stalin that they had hung up and left there, and that was, I think, left over from the June 10th demonstration in the Zocalo led by the.
You have footage of that, Grant?
I do have.
Okay.
Yes, so we have photos. We have photos all throughout Mexico of Joe Stalin showing up. You have photos of in the meetings in the Cañadas that took place in August and September of 2005, when these assholes showed up with the portrait of Joe Stalin, and we tried to take it away from him, saying that it had no business being there. No, and Marcos came to us and said, "Don't be divisive. Everyone is can vote." No, do you have photos of that?
I
To me, the Stalinism is not in the image, but in the urge to censor and purge.
Yeah. I'm glad that they it didn't disappear in July. The other campaign disappeared in July, and when the other campaign resumed in the north in October, the Joe Stalin portraits were not there. And I believe I wasn't in Tijuana. Somebody told me that they were taken away in Tijuana. I think you should be a Zapatista with yarn. No, and I think that, you know, when we began this thing, and I, you know, I'm a writer about it, I support the Zapatista movement, I've been with it since it began, since before it began, you know, I wrote the first articles in 1993, so I see my role as being a part of the movement, and I write about being a part of the movement. I don't know about objectivity is how it wants to put it out there. I think objectivity is an instrument of class oppression, to tell you the truth. So, you know, I stand for something. I take something. You know, I take a position. Now, you know, at the beginning of this thing, we all would go to Chiapas. We'd go and take the film. We'd bring it back. We'd show it to our friends. We'd send our old clothes. Marcos walked around with that one pink pump size 6, the Cinderella syndrome for a long time. See, this is what they send us, you know. But, you know, very early in this game, when the Zapatistas, when the Comandancia had come up to San Cristóbal de las Casas in February of 1994, and we had a lot of access, probably our greatest access to the Comandancia, we would talk with them every morning, and we'd say, what is the best kind of solidarity? And Marcos then said, I think in exasperation, be a Zapatista where you are. No? It didn't catch on. It hasn't caught on for these last 10 years. But I think the best kind of solidarity with Mexico at this point is to be a Zapatista where you are.
Not what I meant exactly. I mean, like, write your senator, or, I mean, if someone...
Don't really, write your senator.
I mean, I'm telling you. Do you know what I mean? People really need to hear concrete tactics. If he is obviously some beautiful idea, but it's not really working, you know, we're all going to say you need to know what one thing to do would be. I have my own ideas. I'd like to hear what
yours would be. Well, I mean, we're always looking for translators, for example, to help translate these articles. That's something you can do an article in 20 minutes if you're a fast translator. We could use your help. I know that Tacha Connor's here with the Supermodels with Oaxaca. They're going to be organizing a series of pickets outside the UN and the Mexican consulate here in New York, which people can participate. If you don't want to be a model or if you're ugly like me, you can be a member of the press corps and the paparazzi. There are other efforts, solidarity, the Movimiento del Barrio, I think, is a very important group to support and get involved in. I know that Anto's involved with it. Our friend RJ, who collaborates with us, is involved in it. Many of you know him. But I just want to counter, because it gets a little testy here. I also believe that objectivity is bullshit, and I don't want anybody to portray my words for me. And regarding the pamphlet that was handed out by my esteemed colleague, it wouldn't pass a fact checker at The Nation or anywhere else. And I'll refresh his memory with a copy of his original emails and my responses to him, which make a lie out of some of his claims. So there you have it, John.
Thank you.
And there's copies here if anybody else really hears a crap.
Thank you, everyone.
Anybody interested in... picking up a copy of Zapatistas without paying taxes is right here, and I've got some, and I've got my new chapbook of poetry, Bumba, which will definitely set the fuse.